Okay, welcome, folks. This is Mike Porky Parry. You are listening to Life on Planet Porky, okay? Thank you very much indeed for joining me today. I've got lots to tell you. The special feature in today's show is the Porky book review, okay? I've got lots of things to tell you about Life on Planet Porky, what's been happening in the second half of today's podcast. But first of all, I want to get stuck into books because you all know I'm a very literary person myself. And when I say I'm literary, I mean I take care to keep myself up to date with modern literature, but some literature that's modern relates back to the past. And of course, the fascination of history grips us all. Now, let me just tell you this. I went to the King's School Chester. A lot of you know that because, of course, I've talked about it before. Martin Lewis, you will know him. He's a financial expert, does a lot of broadcasting, you know, and tells you how to save money. MoneySave.com, I think, was one of his and all that kind of stuff. And what Martin does is he helps people to make the most of their money, but he went to the King's School Chester as well. Now, I wouldn't say Martin's more famous than me, although, of course, he's far more successful because he knows what to do with money in a way I don't. But nevertheless, it means I came from a great school. Now, why am I telling you that I came from the King's School Chester? It's because it was founded by King Henry VIII. King Henry VIII might not have been one of our greatest kings in the sense of, well, you know, what did he do for us? Apart from inventing the Royal Navy, of course. But he was certainly the most colourful. But the latest book I've been sent about Henry VIII is called The Decline and Fall of a Tyrant. Now, that, you know, the title alone gives you a kind of indication this is not going to be a terribly kind book towards Henry VIII. However, I have studied it at length. I've speed-read it as I read all the books that are sent to me. And, you know, there are some dodgy bits in Henry's life, okay? So, for instance, let me read you these couple of paragraphs. The bride was 19, petite, vivacious, and flirty, with a mass of auburn hair tumbling down her back. The groom, 30 years older, at nearly 50 years of age, was enormously fat, flatulent, possessed of a volcanic temper, and had ulcerated legs so putrid that the pus ran down his calves and the stench of the poison could be detected several rooms away. That can't be much fun, can it? Imagine a poor young girl of 19 having to get into bed with this great fat twat. You know, excuse my language, kids, but I mean, I'm not sure how you, maybe fat get is probably a kinder expression, although it can't be too annoying. So this poor 19-year-old girl's got to climb into bed with this ginormous man whose legs are ulcerated, who is in the latter years of his life, can barely walk and all this kind of stuff. And the whole idea is that she's got to procreate with him because he wants more children. So anyway, this was the marriage of Henry VIII to Catherine Howard. Now, this happened in July 1540, and my school, the King's School Chester, was founded in something like 1542 or something like that. So at least Henry had time to found my school before his demise, which came not many years later. Anyway, look. This particular paragraph I've read to you, I can tell you, because having read the book, it's one of many dark episodes, but it's a grimly compelling book, believe me, about the last 7 years of Henry's reign. Now, I mean, it points out that once upon a time, King Henry VIII was handsome, charismatic, athletic, and he turned into really a pretty revolting individual, utterly revolting. And when he met Catherine, he said that all his ailments left him. He thought his legs would heal up. He felt immediately better. I mean, remember, he was consumed with things like, you know, probably, I was going to say something else then, probably cirrhosis of the liver, but almost certainly, what I was going to say, syphilis. Because Henry VIII was a Mad Shagger. When you were King of England in those days, you basically could do what you want and indulge your interest in the, you know, the flesh pots of life with gay abandon. And I don't mean gay in the sense that we use these days. In those days, it was about, you know, you could do whatever you wanted. And so any serving wench in the royal households, and there were plenty of them, Hampton Court Palace, beautiful building. Don't know if you've been there, but if you do, go there and you'll see the size of the kitchen that that they had to have to serve the amount of food that Henry liked to serve to his guests at royal banquets. Hampton Court Palace was one. He had a few others up and down the River Thames because they used to sort of float up and down on the royal barge, which you can actually say, or I can say, having read all the evidence, the royal barge was just a knocking shop on water. A lot of the royal wenches were invited onto the barge and a lot of rogerisation went on because that's the way it was in that life. Now then, reading through this book, and I'll, you know, I'll kind of sub it down for you to give all the best parts. It didn't take long, really, for this marriage to go wrong. Now, the problem was, for any woman marrying the King of England in those days, Henry VIII, is that whilst it sounded like a good idea at the time, and you suddenly became the most famous and most well-protected and most, what's the word I'm looking for? Well, luckiest woman in England, married to the King of England, there was a bit of a price to pay. So what happened here was that 19-year-old Catherine, you know, clearly found Henry revolting, largely because he was revolting, okay? And so she started looking around for a bit of sort of, you know what I mean? You know, a bit of the old, what can I call it, Roger Rooney? Horizontal refreshment and that kind of stuff, okay? Now, the, you know, soon after the marriage, old Henry became so, you know, ill. By the way, he had a 54-inch waist and weighed something like 27 stone or something like that, okay? So quite soon after the marriage, he took to bed and he wasn't even capable of indulging in the sort of procreation that he had hoped for, okay? And lying in his bed, you know, his sick bed and all that, rumours reached him that the woman who'd been called a blushing rose without a thorn, and what that meant in those days was that she had not indulged in any physical recreation with any man before becoming Henry's wife at the age of 19. Although that's odd, really, because in those days people could die, like in the sort of late 20s, early 30s, from all sorts of things, disease and all that. And usually they started on the old, you know, Roger Rooney stuff at about 14 or 15, I think. Well, that's what I've got from my historical journals anyway. And this, you can say this is an historical journal, okay? But anyway, it came to his ears that before she married Henry, Catherine had in fact indulged in, you know, physical rock and roll with her lute teacher. A lute, as you know, is a kind of banjo type thing. Well, it's not really. It's a lute, but you know what I'm talking about. And she'd also apparently been intimate with a guy called Another Man, but thought to be a gardener at one of the royal palaces, okay? Not only that, but it was rumoured also and came to Henry's ears that she quite liked the company of her girlfriends. Now, old Henry, of course, got pretty angry at this, okay? And when he first heard about it, he shouted to one of his knaves, you know, bring me a sword and bring me Catherine, I'm going to kill her. He said he wanted to do it with his own hands. And he rolled out of bed, fell on the floor, was sobbing, and bashed his head on the floor and said to Cardinal Wolsey, who was standing around, why have you brought me such... why am I so unlucky with such ill-conditioned wives, right? Now then, this was the end for Catherine, obviously. A letter was discovered, written by her, to a guy called Thomas Culpeper, said to be a gentleman of the Privy Chamber. And the Privy Chamber, of course, is the king's inner sanctum, like his kitchen sink cabinet, if you know what I mean, you know? And had, in fact, been very close to Henry. Anyway, Catherine had sent this letter to this guy and signed it, "Yours as long as life endures." So, you know, if you read that one way, it could mean, oh, yeah, I love you, you know, and it's great when I'm with you and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, this all came to light about 18 months after the wedding. And as soon as Henry got himself together and was hauled back into bed, he ordered Catherine to be taken to the small green within the Tower of London. Many of you may have been there and seen it, one of the world's biggest tourist attractions, the Tower of London. And she was then put into a room in the tower, which, if she examined who the previous occupant had been, she couldn't have felt too good about it. Because the previous occupant was, in fact, Anne Boleyn. And, excuse me, Anne Boleyn was, of course, executed. She was beheaded. She was put in that room for a few weeks, right, next to the green, then taken out and had her head taken off, all right? And sadly, this came to Catherine as well. She had her head taken off, beheaded, and I don't know whether Henry was having a laugh or something, but she was buried right next to Anne Boleyn, almost like a warning to future wives that, you know, you shouldn't mess around when you're Henry the Eighth's wife, okay? Now, that was quite a fortuitous ending for Catherine, because what Henry did with the people who he thought were his wife's lovers, right, was to treat them with much less decisiveness in their death, okay? One of them was convicted of treason against the king for Rogerizing Catherine, and he was dismembered. So his arms and his legs were taken off one by one by an axe, with an axe, okay? And this clearly was not a very pleasant procedure. You can imagine lying there and all of a sudden, you know, oh, you know, begging for mercy, whoosh, one stroke of the axe, and you've only got one arm. And, you know, you may have thought, well, that's my punishment. No, no way. Very shortly after that, whoosh, another sweep of the axe, from a giant axeman with a black mask on, and you've only got one leg. And if they'd taken your arm and your leg off on the same side of your body, even if that had been the end of your punishment, that would have been a rather difficult existence, wouldn't it? Certainly a lopsided one, obviously. And anyway, it didn't end there. Whoosh! Another sweep of the axe by the axeman with the black mask on, and the second arm had gone. So, you know, nobody's going to make jokes about what we're left with. Hop along, not even Cassidy. But you only got one leg left. And I suppose most of us would settle for that. You know, okay, is that my punishment complete? No, sorry. Whoosh, another sweep of the axe and the second leg's gone. And then the torso was left on the floor. It was on the green, by the way, you know, the Tower of London, and four limbs all dismembered. And Henry was intrigued to see how long the body could survive on its own without any limbs. And when it survived a bit too long, because he thought, well, he'd just die now, he ordered the axeman to chop into the chest through the sternum bone, and then had another servant cut the heart out of the man who had been his wife's lover. And only then did the poor chap die. Now, you've got to remember that Henry, of course, had an iron grip on England. This was the guy who, after all, decided to break away from Rome and tell people that we are going to knock down all the monasteries and kill quite a few of the monks, which wasn't very pleasant at all, and establish the Church of England. And, of course, the Church of England, to this day, is the church that you see in many different forms, in all sorts of buildings, cathedrals and churches and all that kind of stuff, you know, Methodists and all that kind of stuff, which survives to this day. So some would say, well, that was quite demonstrative. However, Henry got worse because he only had a few years to live then. He was terribly ill. And what happened was he sent spies out around the country. He got paranoid about people plotting against him. So he sent spies out around the country, okay, to find out who was talking about him. Now, it was honestly a bit like what it's like today in Pyongyang. You know, Pyongyang is the capital of North Korea, and we all know that's a brutal, horrendous regime. You know, some 3 million people locked up in camps in Pyongyang, because in Pyongyang, if you speak out against the great leader, Kim Il-sung, I think his name is, isn't it? Then you're in trouble. Well, that's what happened in England in the 1500s, okay? And it could result in a death sentence, but not even a nice one. So what people did, evil people, and there are lots of evil people around, by the way, so this is a warning from Planet Porky to all the nice people in the world. Don't, don't take for granted that those who you mix with, you work with, you live with are going to be as nice as you, because often they're not. And if somebody wanted to settle a score with a troublesome neighbour, they would accuse them, they'd go to the local sheriff and accuse them of slandering the king. And that was a really good way of getting rid of somebody, okay? And what would happen then is, Henry had a team of torturers. They would then go round to your neighbour's house when you'd accused your neighbour of slandering the king. You go round to your neighbour's house, okay? And the torturers were very enthusiastic. They were like psychopaths, you know. Some of them were like criminals who he would spare, providing they liked indulging in, you know, horrible forms of torture. One of them, of course, was the red-hot poker up the jacksy, which was a very unpleasant form of... And they did this, by the way, because people said, no, I didn't slander the king. So they said, no, you did. You better confess to it. And they said, I can't confess. I didn't do it. Oh, well, we'll soon find out, because we have a very good way of doing it. And I don't wish to go into detail, because it's rather a horrible thing to have to talk about. But the red-hot poker up the jacksy was done so clinically that a copper tube was inserted into the jacksy first, if you see what I mean. Sorry to sort of get so detailed here, but I don't want you to be under any illusions about how horrible these tortures were. And then the red-hot poker was inserted through the tube, so it actually set fire to your innards, okay? It wasn't too good if you got put in jail either, because in those days, believe it or not, Henry had what he called the bubonic plague prisons. And so if you were a perfectly healthy person but wouldn't admit to slandering the king because your neighbour had said you did, I'm afraid you went into the bubonic jail and you would then die horribly over the next 72 hours with the Black Death or all sorts of other terrible illnesses which were around in those days. Malaria, even, I'm told, in England in the mid-1500s, okay? So, I mean, just to get to the end of this book, and remember, you're listening to Life on Planet Porky, the book review by the Porkmeister. Henry then went on to set his sights on another Catherine, Catherine Parr. Now, Catherine Parr, of all Henry's wives, won. And do you know why? She was ugly. Henry decided that he no longer needed a beauty, but she was a very strong woman, strong personality, calm intelligence, it says in his book, graceful dancing. But the only problem was that this Catherine was deeply in love with Thomas Seymour, who was the brother of Henry's third wife, Jane Seymour, who also came to a sticky end. But anyway, Catherine knew what she was doing in a world where Henry would go around with the red-hot poker treatment to people who didn't please him. She immediately got rid of Thomas Seymour and said, yes, 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 I'd love to become your mistress and your wife. Thomas Seymour was posted to Brussels as the British ambassador, and he accepted immediately for fear of the terrible tortures that Henry could mete out, okay? Now, Henry VIII, after this, all this terrible behaviour, he died in January 1547. Excuse me. I'm out of the bubonic plague. In January 1547, he was 55, but he'd been king for 38 years, okay? He fought wars against Scotland and France in the final few years of his reign. He bankrupted the country by building a navy, but brought no money in. That came later when his daughter, Elizabeth I, was queen, and Francis Drake went and plundered all the gold off the Spaniards. And it took 20 years to put the economy right again. But in a macabre final twist to Henry's life, let me tell you this. His body, which I said was, you know, massive, 54-inch waist, he weighed about 27 stone. They spent a week building a coffin, which they called a casket in those days, which the Americans still call a coffin, a casket. Held his body, but it was so heavy, when they lifted it up, his body sprang a leak because the wood around him was so tight as they nailed the top of it on. And as he lay in state in Hampton Court and wished that the whole of the country would flock to the palace to pay tribute to him, and nobody did, the only people who paid homage to him at his coffin were a bunch of wild dogs yapping and lapping around the remains of King Henry VIII. This is the Book Review. Okay, folks, now you know you're listening to Life on Planet Porky. We've just had the Porky Book Review, and I've had to inform you all about the dastardliness of Henry VIII. But I think it's about time we talked about things that happened on Planet Porky, because I want you all to know. Now, you will have noticed that just last week, there was, of course, a new royal baby born into the fold of the royal household. And I have to say, you know, two young people having their first child, old Prince Harry and Meghan, very pleased for them. And they decided to sort of try and do it their way and all that kind of stuff, you know. So, you know, the royal family's got to move on like everybody else. But the reason I raise this is because I always find it so funny from the job I've come from. I was in Fleet Street for about 25 years, right? And it was just great fun, everything we did. When I was in the United States of America, when I was the Daily Express bureau chief, we had lots of royal engagements because the royal family came over all the time. Diana, in the latter years of her marriage, would come over and go to the Caribbean, and she'd be entertained on the yachts of very rich men. I'm not suggesting for a moment that she was indulging in any, you know, hanky-panky behaviour with them, but she wanted to get away from Charles and the stuffiness of the royal enclosure, you know, Buckingham Palace and St. James's Palace and Kensington Palace, actually. And she would go there and she'd take, you know, a few of her friends with her and all that, and they'd go on these boats. And we had to hire boats. And, you know, once we heard that Diana was in the Caribbean, we'd all fly down from New York down to Barbados, used to start there because that was usually the starting point, or the Florida Keys or something like that, and hire boats. And then for the next 3 or 4 days, we sailed off into the Caribbean Sea and tried to find the Diana boat. And the first one that found it and got the pictures, wow, they were front page all over the world, you know, the following day. But that's what I was going to talk to you about, folks, is that the life of a royal correspondent, I wasn't a royal correspondent, we just did the American side of it, but the life of a royal correspondent in this country is absolutely hapless, honestly. The first thing is to say, you know, insiders and all that. There are no insiders. Nobody knows what's going on inside the royal family. Literally nobody, okay? Because it's such a secret society. And so when you get a massive royal story, about the only thing a royal correspondent can say to a television camera is, the Queen has asked to be kept informed of the situation. That's like if there's been a national tragedy somewhere, something like that. If there's a, you know, a royal birth or something like that, the Queen is said to be, very pleased, or you know, these days it's a bit better. The Queen is said to be thrilled at the birth of a new great grandson. Was it a great grandson? Yeah, it was Archie. That's right. Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. But I felt very sorry for an old mate of mine called Nicholas Witchell, who is the BBC royal correspondent. And the reason I felt a bit sorry for Nick was he froze during a live broadcast. Okay, And it's happened to everybody in broadcasting. You know, I do a lot of radio, I do TV. Your responses have to be instant on live television, live radio. You can't afford to stop and think. You shouldn't work from scripts. Some people prefer working from scripts, but that always catches you out because, you know, situations and circumstances can change around you. I prefer not to work with a script. And so when I saw Nicholas in front of the camera, he wasn't working from a script, and he tried to memorise what he was going to say at the birth of at the announcement of the birth of Prince Archie. So he got as far as the first Anglo-American birth in the British royal family. Now we know, of course, that as I said, the first Anglo-American birth in the British royal family. It is certain. Look, I'm sorry. Once again, and now I'll hand you back. And they went back to the studio, okay? Now, you know, the reason I had a lot of sympathy for Nick is because you don't know how lonely and isolated it is standing there in front of a camera with a microphone in your hand, or usually a microphone clipped onto your tie or your shirt or something. And if you just lose concentration for a minute, and you can lose concentration. And I tell you what, I was interviewing David Cameron once, and it was in a radio studio, okay? And in fairness to me, I like to be fair to myself, I am the portmeister after all. In fairness to me, David Cameron was then only leader of the opposition. But he was in a pretty strong position as an election was coming up against, would that have been Gordon Brown? Yeah, Gordon Brown. Was it Gordon Brown? Yes, it was, yeah. You know, to win the election, get a majority, all that kind of stuff. You know, he was leader of the Tories, and he's a very surprising leader of the Tories, which may have been what happened to me happened. So I'm sitting there in this studio, and I'm looking across the table at him, and I'm asking him questions, and he's giving me politicians' answers, and my eyes completely glaze over because I was trying to provoke some sort of reaction to get something other than, you know, a de facto answer about, you know, immigration or the common market or something else. And I literally forgot who I was talking to. I was staring at him, and my eyes had glazed over, and I was thinking, I don't know who this guy is, and I didn't know what question to ask him because I thought, this guy, I can't remember who he is, but he hasn't said anything remotely interesting so far. What shall I ask him? And I just, you know, it's called corpsing sometimes. You can't say anything because you don't know what you're doing or who you're talking to. Anyway, that came and went. David Cameron went on to become Prime Minister. In my view, one of the worst prime ministers we've ever had, responsible for the Brexit fiasco, when he should have actually taken some action and gone forward. He didn't. He went backwards and said, let somebody else make the decision. But royal correspondents are great people, OK? Because they travel around the world, they do their best, and they have to come back with a story, even though there's no story there. Now, you're probably saying, oh, that's an admission that they make things up. They don't make things up, honestly. They never make things up. They can find stories from, you know, minute detail of what's happening in the royal family. They can spot something that wasn't around yesterday. They can notice an article of clothing that maybe Diana, Princess of Wales, was wearing, or a brooch she was wearing, or a pair of shoes she was wearing. And they go back in the files and find last time that Diana wore this, last time, you know, that brooch came out in public and all that kind of stuff. One of my best friends of the past in Fleet Street was the great James Whittaker. Now, Jimmy to his friends, James Whittaker was byline in the Mirror. And he worked with a guy called Ken Lennox, photographer, great photographer. And James followed the royal family around the world, and Diana in particular, right? We used to see him in America when she came over. He'd sometimes come with her. But where the royal correspondents really loved going was skiing with the royals round about February, March, something like that. They'd go to, I don't know, Closters, Verbier, all them sort of places, which I've never been to be honest, because I'm not a great skier. But James was a great skier. So what James used to do was he would get on the slopes and try and disguise himself and get into, you know, following the royal party down the ski runs and all that kind of stuff, okay? Just for the hell of it, really, or to be on the spot if one of them sort of veered off the piste or something like that, you know what I mean? But anyway, the problem was James always wore a very bright red ski suit, and it ended up with Diana, Princess of Wales, calling him the Big Fat Red Tomato, or the Big Fat Tomato, I think she used to call him. So she always knew when he was around. But the point of my story is, when I think James was 60, he died sadly in, I think James died about 5-6 years ago, and he was just over 70. When he was 60, he had a 60th birthday party at his home, which I think was in Berkshire. And we all went along, you know, old friends, used to meet up at Ascot and the Epsom Derby and all that kind of stuff. And the the part of the house where we had the party was called the Princess Diana Wing. Well, actually, it was called Diana Princess of Wales Wing, to give her a correct title. And that's because James had managed to log up so many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, in expenses following the royal family, and Diana in particular, around the world, that his expenses were ginormous. And with all those expenses, he built an extension on his house. And the extension was almost like a sort of ballroom, if you see what I mean. And that's where we had his party. And I have to say, I remember that was a great night. But that's what the royal correspondents were like. They gave their lives, even on Christmas Day. Even on Christmas Day. And I used to run things on Christmas Day because I was single, didn't have kids, and I didn't want anybody who had children waking up on Christmas Day to lose their mum and dad. I was a very, very kind employer and a charitable man. So I used to go into whatever paper I was working for at the time, usually the Daily Express, and say, right, fellas, even though I'm the most senior man, and even though it's sort of beneath me to run the news desk and the picture desk today, I'll go in and do it. You guys have a good Christmas Day. And the people who couldn't take Christmas Day off were the royal correspondents, because every year, of course, on Christmas Day, every year on Christmas Day, at Windsor Castle, the royal family come out, they take that traditional walk, and they either are arm in arm or maybe, you know, in couples behind each other, and they go to church on Christmas Day. And for years we had to cover that, and for years the same blinking caption came in every day, because that's all it was ever worth, unless one of those great royal correspondents could interpret something, and they did. So, for instance, if Diana was more than 2 feet away from Charles, that was the signal for the royal correspondents to write a fantastic Christmas Day story for Boxing Day's publication. You know, Diana and Charles, miles apart. Well, miles is quite a long way. 2 feet isn't. But we always published them because we believed that our royal correspondents could read the body language of every individual member of the royal family. And if they were more than so many feet apart, it meant they weren't getting on very well and that it was going to be a problem, OK? When I say to you that nobody ever knew what was going on inside the royal family, there were a couple of correspondents who got close. For instance, I know a royal correspondent in the past who got very close to Diana. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment there was any horizontal refreshment going on, but believe me, he became a shoulder for her to cry on. So literally that on one occasion, a picture was taken of Diana in his car with her head on his shoulder weeping because her marriage with Charles had sunk to such depths that, you know, it was all so unhappy. And he didn't use a lot of what Diana told him, just out of decency. Years later, of course, the Diana My True Story, Andrew Morton, who became the confidant of Diana, Princess of the Wales, published the book, which I think has sold now over 20 million copies. But the guy I'm talking about knows who I am, a gentleman, and never, ever revealed it. Let me tell you another little royal story, by the way, which is so interesting about royal correspondence. There was a lady called Jane Andrews, and she was a kind of lady-in-waiting, but really personal assistant to Fergie, the Duchess of... Hang on. My head's gone. You know what I'm talking about. Prince Andrew's wife, okay? Dinah, what's her name? Fergie. You know what I'm talking about anyway. Long blonde, long ginger hair and all that, you know. And what happened was her assistant was called Jane Andrews. And they travelled around the world together on royal engagements, but so did all the royal correspondents. Now, in a very strange twist of fate, Jane Andrews murdered her American boyfriend back at her flat in Kensington in London after she left royal service. So Fergie, Duchess of, somebody will remind me of that in a minute, was no longer her employer, but was, you know, mortified and shocked to learn that the woman who'd been alongside her for a good, I don't know, probably 10 years, had suddenly turned into a murderer. What she did is, her boyfriend wouldn't marry her. So Jane Andrews hit him over the head with a cricket bat, and while he was unconscious, stabbed him, and then fled, and was found in a lay-by somewhere in the West Country, in a car, in a state of, you know, total, I don't know, just dishevelment and all that kind of stuff. She was convicted of murder, even though she pleaded that it was aggravated, that he had in some way assaulted her. That wasn't proven to be true, and the family are very angry that she tried to besmirch her son's death, and she served 14 years in jail. But this is the twist of the story, folks. Several members of the Royal Press Pack over the years, travelling with Fergie, Duchess of, you know, Prince Andrew's wife. Can't remember if she was Duchess of now, but I will in a minute, don't worry. Several members of the Press Pack over the years had become intimate with Jane Andrews. And the greatest fear for these guys, was that at the trial, because she was pleading, you know, sort of aggravation, I'm not sure if she pleaded not guilty. I think she pleaded not guilty to murder, for which she was subsequently convicted. Because it was a trial, it means that all sorts of witnesses are called for character assessment and all that. They were terrified. They were terrified that they were going to be called and asked about that night in Verbier, or that night in Closters, or that royal trip down to Australia. When you were there, what was the arrangement that you had with the Duchess's first lieutenant and personal assistant, Jane Andrews? Mr. whatever his name was, do you wish to comment? I'm telling you, it was a worrying time. Okay, folks, you have been listening to Life on Planet Porky, the book review, and everything else that happens. Thanks for listening, folks. Back with you soon. Imagine a poor young girl of 19 having to get into bed with this great fat twat, you know. Excuse my language, kids, but I mean, I'm not sure how you maybe fat get is probably a kinder expression, although it can't be too. So this poor 19-year-old girl's got to climb into bed with this ginormous man whose legs are ulcerated, who is in the latter years of his life, can barely walk and all this kind of stuff. And the whole idea is that she's got to procreate with him because he wants more children. So anyway, this was the marriage of Henry VIII to Catherine Howard. I don't wish to go into detail because it's rather a horrible thing to have to talk about, but the red hot poker up the jacksie was done so clinically that a copper tube was inserted into the jacksie first, if you see what I mean. Sorry to sort of get so detailed here, but I don't want you to be under any illusions about how horrible these tortures were. And then the red hot poker was inserted through the tube, so it actually set fire to your innards, okay? A lute, as you know, is a kind of banjo type thing. Well, it's not really, it's a lute, but you know what I'm talking about.